You are listening to Pratt on Texas. I'm your host, Robert Pratt. The number for the show, 800-687-0790. Something special for the hour. That's right. We're going to visit with space historian, science writer, really good author, and warrior for free markets, too, and a lot of other good things. In fact, he's a warrior for all that's good and right in the world. He does a lot of that warring his website, BehindTheBlack.com. It's Robert Zimmerman with us today. And, Bob, great to have you back on the program. An hour will go so fast, and there's so many things we could talk about. But I just want to tell you, and we'll get back to it. I'll talk about it later. But Pioneer, give us the thumbnail. This is a book you wrote a long time ago. You got a new book out. It's fiction. It's a novel. You were right. You emailed me. You said if I picked it up and started reading it, I wouldn't be able to put it down. And, well, I did because it got to be the middle of the night and I had to go to bed. But I finished it the next day. It's fabulous. I truly enjoyed your book, Pioneer. Tell everybody, we'll talk more about it in a moment, but tell everybody just the thumbnail about how this came about.
Well, back in the 80s, early 80s, I was still unpublished and I wasn't even in the movie business yet. I was just out of college and I was just trying to figure out what I was going to do with myself. I wrote a science fiction book. And at the time, you needed an agent to get something sold, and I didn't, I've never found an agent that I wanted to work with, and I couldn't find any agent at the time. The one I did find just was worthless, didn't do anything. So it didn't get published, and so I put it aside, and I sat in the file cabinet of my house for 3-4 decades. And then in the last 6 months, I've been watching a lot of the modern science fiction movies that have been made, like The Martian and others, and said, I haven't read that book in decades. Let me just take it out and look at it. Maybe there's something there marketable or interesting. And I expected when I read it, it would be a typical first novel, incoherent, emotionally immature, and all that kind of stuff. And I'm starting to read it, and I can't put it down. And I didn't really remember it very much. Really didn't remember it in any detail.
Right.
I'm serious.
I believe that. People who don't do what I do or you do for a living don't understand this. I don't remember. People come up to me and tell me in detail things they thought were terrible or brilliant that I said and talked about. And I will tell you, at least 60-70% of the time, I don't recall it at all. I mean, I vaguely have a memory that it was discussed, but you do it every day. You write something every day. It is hard. And I can imagine that. I mean, it's been a lot. You're an old man now. Hell, you were a young whippersnapper back then.
Well, I was I said to my wife, this is a good book. I'm surprised. And so I decided, let's put it in print. Nowadays, you don't need an agent or a publisher. Right. You can just put it as an e-book and make it available to the world. And, so I figured the investment is not a lot of money, and it's worth doing. Put it in print. And I've been really pleased with the response. I think people do enjoy it. And your response doesn't surprise me because,
it was really good. Yeah.
It's a real, we'll talk about it more.
And I want to talk about it a little later, but I want to back up. There's so many things to talk about with you. And by the way, folks, PrattOnTexas.com, it's right there in the latest news. Pioneer by Robert Zimmerman. Click through. You can order it through Amazon as an ebook, a Kindle for your Kindle reader. That's how I read it. Or you can go to BehindTheBlack.com, and he's got links to Barnes & Noble and some other places. I want to talk about several things because it all sort of leads up to the book later. But there was an interesting piece you had at Behind the Black. It's been a busy week there. You've got a lot of posts. But on the 15th, the man who suited up astronauts during the 60s passes away at 101. His name was Joseph Schmidt. He's in all those pictures, and he all of them, Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo programs.
Yeah.
And you wrote an important man but invisible at the time. In one of your books you wrote, which is truly one of my favorite nonfiction books, everything about it, I really like how you told the story. Genesis, the story of Apollo 8. You wrote, I included pictures of the three Apollo 8 astronauts getting suited up, with one picture including an unnamed technician in the background whom I now suspect was Schmidt. Until now, I'd never even noticed the technician at all. The focus was the astronauts, which, though reasonable, is also not really thorough. Well, this is so true. And isn't that true, though, for everything in our economy and in our history? We think of Christopher Columbus, but every one of those boats had a captain. Every one of those boats, they had navigators. All these other players get lost. And you know, this leads into your book, Pioneer, because your book is about being a pioneer. It's about exploration. But it takes so many people. But aren't they really all, it's all about, when it's successful, it's the individual achievement of everybody working together. And I think that's one thing we share as an idea, Bob, and that is that collectivism doesn't work very well. Individuals working together does work very well.
Yes. And the distinction is very subtle, but it's like humongous. It's the most important distinction in the world. And the terminology that I use that really distinguishes the two ideals of between collectivism and individual achievement working together is top down versus bottom up.
Sure.
The one reason that NASA worked so well in the 60s is because it was bottom up management. It really was. NASA's managers at the top came up with a plan for how it was to be done. But then they were totally agreeable with the idea that it would be run from the bottom. And the famous story that I tell in Genesis about this is how the decision to send the Apollo 8 astronauts to the moon was made by lower management people who then surprised the head of NASA, James Webb, with a decision. And he was like, what? What? And he says, yep, we're going to do it. And the president didn't even know about it. And so that's the distinction. Top down is when you have collectivism, where someone plans it and tells everybody else what to do, and no one really feels that they have any creative part in it. Bottom up is a situation where the suits were made by private companies, and this guy, his job was to make sure they worked and sat on the astronauts properly. So he had his place in the space program that was absolutely essential. And the astronauts, one of my readers on Behind the Black pulled out a link to a Norman Rockwell painting, a beautiful painting of two Gemini astronauts being suited up, and they show two technicians helping them, and one of them is Schmidt. Who happens to not be the guy in the Genesis picture. It's the other guy. There were two of them that worked. And I actually don't know the other guy's name. I'd have to research to find out. But, you know, you don't see them because the key is the astronauts. They were the ones risking their lives. But everybody, the hundreds of thousands of people that helped build the spacecraft and the capsules and everything involved, played crucial roles because they designed the pieces from the bottom up.
Well, and I'll tell you, one of the things that makes, even though I, you know, you and I both know launching into space, getting into orbit is not routine. I mean, this is your area of expertise. You wrote the encyclopedia of all the things that have been launched. And you've written many books on Hubble, and you write a lot of feature stories for magazines, science, and whatever. Here's the thing. It's not routine, but I get it. If you don't really understand how hard it is, you might think it is. And that's these launches of SpaceX. But what makes, and of course their big rocket testing facility is in McGregor outside of Waco. They're building their own private launch facility down in Boca Chica Beach and near Brownsville. But what makes watching their videos fun? It's like the old films of NASA where you saw all the engineers, you saw all these people conferring and working instead of, you know, a polished face. Yeah, they got the employee that hosts these videos, but the videos are entertaining to me, even if you don't really know that much about the launches, because you hear them and see all these minds, all these people working together to do things human beings have never done before. And by God, they're doing them. They're doing things that all the bureaucrats said couldn't be done and shouldn't be done.
On top of that, you're actually watching with the SpaceX launches, you're actually watching the engineers who are involved in actually making it happen. So when it succeeds, you can see the absolute glee and joy in their face for their achievement. It isn't a public relations guy or a hired announcer. It is actually the engineers who did it bottom up. One of the things that SpaceX so far has not done, thank God, is when you listen to a NASA launch, whenever the rocket leaves the launch pad, they have this really pat written announcement, the launch of the 23rd mission of bringing us the future of space. And it's totally fake. They don't do that on SpaceX launches. They just simply tell you what happens, and they're very down to earth, bottom up, excited about what they're achieving, and from the heart. And this is once again the distinction, and it's really important. I will tell you, it's not just, you know, one of the things, SpaceX makes it seem almost easy what they're doing. And as you say, Robert, it's not easy.
No.
One of the things about the astronauts, all history of astronauts from the beginning, both Russian and American and Chinese, is they are the cream of the crop. They're in many ways ordinary people too when you meet them. But the one thing they almost, it's a mistake. They make this look so easy. And it isn't. And they tell us how good humans can be in a tough situation. And that's really the lesson they're teaching us. But if you don't think about it, you think, oh, this is not hard. They get it all right all the time. Well, no, it's really hard. And they demonstrate that humans can do amazing things if we really want to.
We're visiting with Bob Zimmerman of BehindTheBlack.com, a science writer and author. We'll come back in a moment after this break. We're visiting with Robert Zimmerman of BehindTheBlack.com. And Bob, you had a piece up at the website about this satellites. I think it's was in my morning update today where I talked about you were going to be on the program, where you said the uncertainty of science. Scientists using the Orbiting Carbon Observatory have found that the bulk of carbon dioxide in recent years came from tropical jungles at the equator, not human activity, located mostly in the northern hemisphere. And, you know, I posted this up at our Facebook page, the commentary, where the headline just says, satellite shows increased carbon dioxide coming from jungles, not factories. And one of the listeners wrote, talk about destroying all environmentalist talking points, narratives. This one's going to leave a mark. And I wrote back, well, you obviously didn't read what Bob said, because Bob's right. Tell him what you said about the climate science community.
Well, yeah, the problem I'm almost anticipating, and actually if you read the article that I linked to, they start to do it right there. And
yeah, I read it. I've highlighted that in my copy here. Yeah,
it's just amazing. The community, they're dependent on the government funds, and most of the government, federal government, which gives this money out, is focused on creating a crisis mode based on the idea of human-caused global warming. So these scientists, dependent on this money and having lost sight of the ethics of science, will be forced to spin this to somehow link it to human activity. But in doing so, they're either fooling themselves or they're lying to everybody else, because all their models, every single model that they have, assume that the increase of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would be focused where the industrial regions are. That's where the carbon dioxide is produced. And so why shouldn't OCOs see that in the northern latitudes or in the industrial areas? But it doesn't. It sees them over the jungles. And this is very counterintuitive, because plants use the carbon dioxide and turn it into oxygen. And so you would think just the opposite. You'd see less carbon dioxide over the jungles, which the climate models call a sink of carbon dioxide. It's a place the carbon dioxide disappears into the plant life. But it doesn't appear to be the case, which just throws everything out, and it really just says we don't understand. The models are crap, and we just do not yet understand how the climate functions, and you cannot make any assumptions or conclusions yet about what's going to happen.
But that doesn't attract grant funding.
Well, in good sense, in the modern...
It would in the right way, but not political funding. Yeah, but if it's all politicized and the people handing out the money have a political agenda, the things they want the so-called science to support, that's the game now. And you're not going to get the money. It's not pure science anymore. It's dogma.
No. It's all been corrupted. I mean, there was a major sea change in how money for science research got funded after World War II. Before then, almost all funding came from private sources, and private sources were not monolithic. You got many different private companies, individuals from all walks of life and all perspectives. And so the research covered a wide range of perspectives, and therefore it tended not to get politicized because the competition forced it to look for the truth. But after the World War II, we tended to shift all the funding from private to the government, federal government, and it's a monolithic government which has an agenda, and it's a political agenda by politicians who have tended to like the idea of crisis to encourage more money, and that's where the game is, and that's corrupted the climate field very badly. A lot of the science fields, Robert, are not corrupted, but because they don't depend so much on the government money. This one has become badly hurt.
Yeah, I wrote in my commentary, I said, it's Zimmerman's refusal to let science become dogma that separates him from so many other science writers today. And then the second idea here, I said his confidence in freedom and capitalist free markets separate him from a much larger part of our society. And we're really talking about, that's what you were extending that idea right there. What's happened is it's not a private thing anymore. It's being driven by political ideology and political goals, and it's corrupted, or it has made it easy for those who fall prey to corruption to be corrupted in this area of science, because there's not one of their models that's been right. I'm not talking about just this model, none of the important big stuff they predicted, none of the highfalutin scientists, whether it's the Hu-Hey or whatever the hell her name is at Texas Tech that gets a lot of attention, and all these people, nothing they've done in science, if you can't predict it, it's not there. That doesn't mean that the science itself can't be good moving towards understanding it better. But these people claim that everything they suggest is fact. It's consensus. It's the way it is. But their science doesn't back that up. It's dogma. It's nothing but dogma.
Yeah. Once again, top down versus bottom up, Robert. This has to do with power. When you go from the bottom up, you've distributed the power to many different people competing. When you go top down, it's monolithic and it becomes a power game with only a few people wielding the power, and that produces corruption.
All right, when we come back on Pratt on Texas with Bob Zimmerman of BehindTheBlack.com, we're going to go to a Martian volcano. Yeah, and then we'll talk about that, and I think that'll lead us right into his old but new book, Pioneer.
Here's a man who feels sorry for those needing to make their country great again. Texas has always been great. It's Robert Pratt of Pratt on Texas.
We're visiting with Robert Zimmerman of BehindTheBlack.com, famed science writer and author and space historian and talk show pundit and everything else. And we're going to do a show soon. I guarantee you, Bob, we'll do a show soon where we're not going to even talk about space. We're just going to talk about the academia fascists and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
Because you do such a good job of putting those things together for people on Behind the Black. To keep up with it. But I want to talk about your book, your old new book. By the way, folks, if you click through at proudontexas.com, it's an ebook. It's only $4. And it's really fun. I thought it was one of the, I read some sci-fi science fiction and I found some really good stuff, but, this actually, I'm not yanking your chain. It was one of the better that I've read. I think it's more realistic than some in a way. I don't know how to explain that, but, if you read it,
actually,
you think that. Go ahead.
I mean, Robert, it falls under a subgenre of science fiction which exists today called hard science fiction, which is science fiction that is really trying to, which is what originally science fiction was, which is try to use what we know and what we think we might learn and create a story of the future based on hard facts. And that's where my and what I like to write about. I like to talk about the uncertainties and what we know and what we don't know as a nonfiction writer. Well, when I wrote this, I wasn't yet a historian, but I was really much interested in what was known about space and what was known then about space and what that implied the future would be like. And that's where it's based on. It's trying to capture the future history, the future of human exploration of the solar system based on what I knew then on what was known about Mars and other places, the asteroid belt, what I thought might end up being learned, and also somewhat of what I knew about American history and the colonization of the New World and how that exploration unfolded, because I think they're comparable.
You're telling that story. I mean, it's, you know, they used to say of Star Trek, Gene Roddenberry was it was a space western. You're telling the story of pioneers, and it's a parallel because it's not because you're retelling an old story out of laziness. It's because that's how it works. I mean, that's the repeated story. You had a piece on BehindTheBlack.com about Europe's trace gas orbiter detecting clouds over the western slopes of a Martian volcano, the giant one there, and you said it's not a new discovery, a confirmation. Well, you know, this is October 16th of 2017. You wrote this book three and a half, four decades ago. And you knew this was the kind of thing that was going to matter if we're going to colonize it. And that's part of the book, is it not? I mean, they went there, they took the risk, and they found a place where there was water.
Well, it's interesting. When I wrote the book, all I had were Mariner orbiter pictures of Mars, as well as Voyager landers. And at the time, those orbiting pictures showed what looked like river valleys. So I decided, well, you know, if we're going to pick a river valley, even if it's dry now, is likely going to have, this is my guess, underground water left over from when it was a wet surface environment. And so they put the colony in that valley. I picked Mangala Vallis, which was near the giant volcanoes, just because it was a cool place, and for the idea of water. And, you know, then I create a history whereby the discovery of underground water on Mars makes it possible for the colony to exist. And this is how it's going to outplay out in the future. I mean, it's pretty obvious. The difference is that technologically we might be able to pin down where those springs and water sources are long before humans even get there, because we have technology that didn't exist back in 1982 to do that.
Well, but certainly, I mean, this piece on this new piece is, you're right about this, is suggest water ice glaciers once flowed down the slopes, and that some of the ice, in other words, this observer from the Europe's trace gas orbiter, indicates or suggests that ice remains trapped in underground caves and lava tubes there. So, I mean, this is, you're going to have this. And then you add to that the very recent post you had about it looks like conditions may be very good for producing oxygen and fuel for Martian CO2.
That's right. And this is all necessary technology for eventually getting there. I mean, the interesting thing about Pioneer, though, let's talk about this, is that it spends very little time on Mars.
Right.
I create a Martian colony, but most of the book is not on Mars, because it's not about... The colony is the foundation for the storytelling and what happens next. But the colony is only the jumping off place for the adventure.
It's no different than it being Dodge City, and it's the last telegraph line. And from there, the same type people that settled that area and pushed the frontier, they're still pushing frontiers. And that's what you see in the book Pioneer. And I really enjoyed it. I thought that one of the things that made it enjoyable to me that would surprise people who really have only watched the shortcut sci-fi, and of course you always have to have some shortcuts, but the shortcut sci-fi, is a lot of this book revolves around things that aren't going to go away tomorrow, and that's orbital mechanics. I mean, and you think back, okay, it's going to take them 20 years to intercept something's orbit, or it's going to take 3 years, these mining ships, you're signing on. I know that people will read this, ignorant people, and I don't mean that as a pejorative, they're just ignorant, will think, who the hell would sign on to a six-year journey? Folks, read books like 2 Years Before the Mast and all of these other great Americans. That's what even kids with money signed up for, to see the world just 200 years ago. They were oftentimes 2, 4, 6, 8 year commitments, and a lot of people never made it home. They died at sea. They died on some island. This isn't new.
No, it isn't. The oil, whale oil ships out of New England routinely would be gone for a minimum of 2 years.
Yeah, so all you got to do is Scion, Melville.
Yeah, and they would, Melville really portrayed that life very well in you know,
Moby Dick. Yeah.
Moby Dick, thank you. But you were going for a long time, and your wife and your kids knew they might not see you for years. And that's just how it had to be. Now, in that case, it wasn't because of orbital mechanics. They could have come back much sooner, but actually economics forced them to stay out. They had to collect enough whale blubber to make the voyage profitable. And in a sense, orbital mechanics will influence the asteroid miners in the future. My main character is an asteroid miner. He returns from a four-year mission to the asteroids, bringing back a small asteroid that has lots of minerals and water on it for the Martian colony, make a lot of money from that, but it takes time to do it, and you can't travel in space fast. The technology isn't there, and it won't be, I think, for many, many, many centuries before we'll be able to travel.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that and what happens in Pioneer when we return from this break on Pratt on Texas, my friends. We're visiting with Bob Zimmerman, BehindTheBlack.com, one of my absolute favorite websites. I tend to visit it every night. We're visiting with Bob Zimmerman of BehindTheBlack.com. He's got a new book out. It's an old book written many years ago, now put in ebook format, and it's excellent. It is science fiction instead of his standard, you know, historian nonfiction stuff, and which, by the way, is very good too. And you can order all that at BehindTheBlack.com. Bob, your book Pioneer, some snowflake read it and didn't like it very much. Everybody else did, but the snowflake put this, and I know it's a snowflake of sorts. However, the main character, the narrator, this is the review, is ceaselessly, childlessly, and pointlessly antagonistic to everyone on board the ship throughout the book. It makes it impossible to feel any shred of liking or understanding for him, which, by the way, I don't agree with that at all. This person doesn't understand the seeking fame and fortune and the kind of people who do that. But it says, and ultimately makes it impossible to really care what happens to him. This is someone who really had never worked in the private sector.
Maybe so.
You know, I'm self-employed, and I always have been, because I know I can't work in those kind of organizations. And if you read history, you will find that a lot of these great people, that's why it's so easy for the liberals to tear them down later, by the way. They're not these perfect, wonderful people. They are the most driven, unbelievably driven, selfish. In other words, their goal is what matters. The people around them, they can be kind, they can be nice. All of this is true. But they tend to be very driven people. That's my history of explorers and people who have built something from nothing. This tends to, the very thing this person can't understand is the personality that the left is trying to stamp out of our culture and neuter us all, because they don't like this kind of thing. This person obviously took great offense to it. I read it, and it sounds like me and a lot of other people I know, maybe why John Batchelor calls you a grumpy or what, a curmudgeon or whatever he calls
sometimes,
you.
Yeah.
But this is who explorers are. And as a historian, you have a lot of experience in that, looking at how this hemisphere was colonized, how this country was colonized.
Yeah. Tough. That's the word that comes to my mind. You've got to be tough. And the people that will explore the solar system and settle it, just like the pioneers that settled the American West, were tough. They were flinty, you know, difficult. They could be hard to live with. But at the same time, they're human beings who do have empathy for others. But they recognize they live in a tough world, and so toughness is required. And it's not something that, this is something I remember when I was writing this in 82. People are going to be tough, so I'm going to make these characters tough. And they're going to be sometimes like fingernails across chalk, and across a blackboard. And that's unfortunately the reality of what it'll be. And I was trying to portray real people in that real dangerous, exposed situation and try to capture the reality of what it'll be like.
But look how our society has changed since you wrote this in 82, when we were still, the Westerns were running on all the local television stations every day. We were still celebrating. We were coming out of it culturally, but we were still celebrating that. And we had a respite with Ronald Reagan where we celebrated the idea of this. And now we have a culture that celebrates the weakling, the wimp, don't do it. It's too risky. We can't do anything. It's too risky.
You've got a schizophrenic culture that's split across a very widening gap between one side that still honors individual achievement and being ambitious towards creating great things, and another side that, as you say, wants people to be wimps and fearful of any achievement at all. I mean, those are very black and white descriptions, but that's how I perceive it. You can be kind and sympathetic and charitable towards other people without giving up your ambition and goals and desire to achieve great things. And that's
certainly you can, but a lot of these people aren't charitable and not, I'm not talking about your characters. I'm talking about explorers. Some of them are the nicest people you would have ever wanted to know
and
read about it. And some of them are not at all. But that doesn't and shouldn't, like trying to tear down Columbus statues, that shouldn't give reason or justification.
They're human beings. You've got to describe them as people, all kinds.
His name is Robert Zimmerman. His website is behindtheblack.com, and he's got many books, including a new fiction book written way back in 1982, just published up, and it's an ebook, and I loved it, absolutely loved it. It's called Pioneer. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can go to proudontexas.com, take a look at what I said about it, and link through to buy it. It's only about $4 at Amazon, $3.99 at Amazon. We got about a minute here. I just wanted to finish that thought about tearing down heroes. You know, in your book, they have a monument to the people that discovered where this colony is on Mars. We build monuments to people. Should we go back then after the fact when we find out, oh, that guy did something bad? I mean, it doesn't change the fact that he still did something fabulous, something amazing.
No human being on Earth is perfect. And therefore, when someone achieves something great, you remember them for the great thing they achieve, and you also remember them for their imperfections. It makes them human. And to want to destroy the past or forget the past because of those imperfections is to denigrate the great achievement. And that's also to try to blot it out, and that's a mistake. And that's it's a testament to ignorance, and it's honoring ignorance, and that's the one thing that we must never do. We got to learn and grow, and when you see great achievement,
very well said, Bob Zimmerman, a testament to ignorance. I love it. Thanks a lot, my friend, for coming on the show today. Long live liberty, long live Texas, and may God bless us all. Good evening to you.